ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 24th of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The White House is today hosting a new round of talks between Israel and Lebanon with the aim of extending the 10-day ceasefire that will expire shortly. It comes as Donald Trump issues yet more threats against Iran and insists he's not in a rush to make a peace deal. Correspondent Rachel Clayton is in Washington and joined me earlier. Rachel, this is the first time that Donald Trump has spoken since extending the ceasefire, it seems, indefinitely. What's he had to say?
That's right. Well, he wouldn't provide a timeline for when the talks between Iran and the US would resume, and he also wouldn't provide any sort of timeline for when the ceasefire would end. Take a listen to what he said.
It's amazing what we've done. So I've done that within that period of time that I mentioned, but I don't want to rush myself, you know, because every story says, oh, Trump is under time pressure. I'm not. No. You know who's under time pressure? They are.
He also said he would never use a nuclear bomb on Iran when he was asked directly about whether he'd use nuclear weapons, which is interesting because before now, Trump's been quite quick to escalate his rhetoric. It was only about a week ago when he said he was going to completely obliterate Iran. He's now seemingly pulling back on that tone and being a lot calmer. He's sort of trying to, it seems, push the message that he's not in a rush and it'll all happen on his own timeline. But at the same time, tensions are really escalating in the Strait of Hormuz. Trump earlier today threatened to use the US military to fire on any boats laying mines in the strait. And we've just got word from CENTCOM that the USS George H.W. Bush, which is a huge military ship, has just arrived in the Middle East in the Indian Ocean too. So there's an even bigger presence of US military personnel there to enforce that naval blockade. The US military has also seized another ship in the Indian Ocean that was allegedly carrying sanctioned oil towards China. So there does seem to be a lot happening, not only in the strait, but in and around that strait. And the US really is bolstering the number of military personnel they have there. I think the number of ships in the Middle East are now at the same number as they were in 2003 when the US was at war with Iraq.
And in the meantime, we have the White House hosting talks between Israel and Lebanon. What's the latest with their negotiations?
It's a crucial time for this ceasefire in particular. It expires in just a few days, and the Israeli Defense Minister has said that Israel's waiting for the green light from the US to begin striking again. The US has had, or the White House has not said anything official on that. They haven't responded. Lebanon, though, is reportedly wanting to extend this ceasefire for between 20 and 40 days. Hezbollah is not taking part in these talks at all. It didn't take part in the first ones either, but it has said it supports the ceasefire in Lebanon. These talks are also incredibly symbolic. The first talks last week were the first time Israel and Lebanon had sat down face-to-face in more than 30 years. And the continuation of the ceasefire affects the continuation of the one between the US and Iran. It was a key term for Iran to stop the fighting with the US, the ceasefire in Lebanon. So if that fails, it could end up negatively affecting the ceasefire that Iran and the US have.
Rachel Clayton in Washington there. Well, after a wave of assassinations targeting top Iranian officials and a supreme leader reportedly in hiding, it's not clear who is really running Iran. Iranians have told the ABC the military's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is increasingly calling the shots. An analyst warned the regime's political leaders are becoming more hardline. Bridget Rollison reports from Jerusalem.
When the US and Israel went to war with Iran, regime change appeared to be a key goal. But instead of collapsing after the assassinations of dozens of senior figures, including its supreme leader, it's evolved in a direction many analysts now see as more radical and extreme.
We're seeing evidence that more hardline elements are taking up key positions in the Iranian government. We're seeing that their military strategy is following a blueprint that is different from what they used before, which is much more aggressive.
That's Trita Parsi, vice president of the Quincy Institute.
But we do know that many of the more pragmatic elements within that Iranian context, such as Ali Larijani, have been assassinated and have been replaced with more hawkish voices.
The shift is being felt inside Iran. In Tehran, Mehdi, whose name we've changed for his protection, describes the country growing more oppressive by the day.
Clearly, the regime has grown much harsher. In the wake of recent events and the loss of key figures, its behaviour has only intensified. Everything has become much worse. None of us dare to go out with our phones anymore. This is the most oppressive and security-heavy environment I've ever experienced in my life.
The decapitation strike that killed 86-year-old Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei in much of his inner circle created a void quickly filled by his more extreme son, Mojtaba Khamenei. Tehran University professor and regime supporter Fouad Azadi says the US was naive to think killing the Supreme Leader would mean the regime would fall.
It's institution-based, not individual-based. So the constitution was written after the revolution. It was designed to make sure that people are assassinated or not around. The country continues to survive.
Mojtaba Khamenei's rise is believed to have elevated the more radical elements of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC. The IRGC is a powerful branch of Iran's military created to protect the Islamic regime. Unlike the regular army, it answers directly to the unelected supreme leader and plays a major role in security, foreign policy, and Iran's nuclear and missile programs, operating alongside elected officials who handle day-to-day governance. But there's uncertainty over who is truly in charge, amid US claims Mojtaba Khamenei was left disfigured in the strike that killed his father. He hasn't been seen in public since.
I think he is still important when it comes to a critical decision. First and foremost, it is the IRGC. He is very close to them, they are close to him, and they are the main fighting force now.
Seema Shain from Israel's Institute for National Security Studies says the IRGC and its commander, Ahmed Vahidi, are increasingly calling the shots.
First of all, he is someone who grew up in the IRGC, but from Israel's point of view, he is the one who was responsible for the attack on the Israeli embassy in Argentina. And 2 years later on the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, more than 100 people have been killed in those two accidents.
There's also signs of friction at the top of Iran's leadership. There have been reports of tensions emerging between the IRGC and the elected officials sent to Pakistan to try to negotiate an end to the war with the US. Kiana, a Tehran resident, told the ABC she fears what lies ahead under a more hardline leadership.
The regime has changed, but not in the way we expected or hoped. For now, a group of clerics has stepped aside and instead a group in suits has come forward. Right now, the regime is extremely dangerous.
For many opponents of the regime, this is their worst fear, a system increasingly dominated by the IRGC, with a younger, more hardline supreme leader positioned to rule for life. This is Bridget Rollison in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
There are still big questions about exactly who will get kicked off the National Disability Insurance Scheme over coming years and how that'll be determined. The federal government says there'll be a new assessment process to judge how severely someone's disability impacts their life after scrapping the list of impairments which currently guarantees access to the scheme. Evelyn Manfield reports from Parliament House.
As the government's plan to overhaul the NDIS sinks in, concerns are quickly emerging.
While there's a need to improve processes and get more consistency, we think that there's some real detail missing in how they're doing these assessments.
That's Amanda Curran, Chief Psychologist at the Australian Association of Psychologists.
We are concerned that there's not been a lot of input from the allied health sector into what these assessments really need to look like.
As part of Labor's plan to control the spiralling cost of the NDIS, it plans to reduce participation in the scheme from its current level of 760,000 down to 600,000 people by the end of the decade. That's a difficult task, given it's currently forecast to have 900,000 participants by then. The government's proposing to use a new assessment tool to determine whether or not someone can get access, probably from 2028. Emma Bennison is the Chief Executive of the Disability Advocacy Network Australia.
I think functional capacity assessments are generally a good thing.
The assessment will consider someone's functional capacity. In other words, how their disability impacts on their day-to-day life. Until now, the central criteria for access has been a diagnosis.
I think getting into the question of diagnosis and levels of diagnosis and all of those sorts of things, it's fraught with subjectivity and complexity. So yes, I think assessing functional capacity in the context of the scheme makes very good sense. However, it's only as good as the tool, and it's only as good as the assessors who deliver that assessment.
The government says the tool will be produced with input from a technical advisory group and people with disability. It could look to the World Health Organization's model. It measures things like the impact on someone's mobility or self-care on a scale from none to cannot do. Michelle Oliver from Occupational Therapists Australia says allied health professionals must be involved.
There's a lot of complexities and levels to understanding what somebody's functional capacity is and making recommendations to support an individual around what support needs they may have.
Now, in making its case, the government says it must return the NDIS to its original purpose of helping people with significant and permanent disability. But the Disability Advocacy Network says if it plans to move 160,000 people off the scheme, alternative supports need to be in place.
What we're calling for is that nobody is moved off the scheme until such time as those supports are built and in place, because otherwise we'll have people going off the scheme into an abyss. Based on past experience, we will probably see people taking their own lives if they're forced off of the scheme without there being adequate supports.
Emma Bennison from Disability Advocacy Network Australia, ending that report by Evelyn Manfield and Samantha Dick. Community sporting groups are feeling the brunt of rising fuel costs, with many players and volunteers having to travel long distances for training and competitions. Clubs are warning they're seeing dwindling numbers, and a key sporting body is calling for targeted financial relief to keep the ball rolling. Samantha Girling prepared this report.
Lois Garner is proud of her 15-year-old daughter Tully for reaching state-level basketball. But lately, there's more than pre-game nerves. It's the stress of simply getting to training.
So really, the fuel crisis has added a considerable amount to our trips. I mean, it used to be probably about $100 each way, and now we're looking at least $150 each way. So, you know, the return trip being about $300 at a minimum.
Every few weeks, they drive the 800-kilometre round trip from their home in Geraldton to Perth for training. They also fear the cost of flying to nationals.
I think what it's going to do is probably make me think about other ways that I can reduce costs. We've made a commitment to basketball and a commitment to nationals, so whatever it takes, we're going to have to get there.
Equestrian WA Chief Executive Robert Kennedy says the fuel prices hit horse riders straight away, with some recent events drawing half as many competitors as usual. And he says several volunteers have requested financial support to get to events.
We want to support them. It shouldn't be hitting them in the back pocket. So we're taking on that and absorbing those costs at the moment. But there's only so long that we can do that for as well.
A recent survey by WA's peak sporting body, Sport West, has found participation rates have dropped in some sports since fuel prices surged. It's calling on the state government to provide financial relief for clubs, regional programs and volunteers. Troy Kirkham is the chief executive.
What we don't want is we don't want those costs to then be passed on to participants, which then creates an opportunity where people are missing out on sport because they simply can't afford it. So when it starts to become an access and equity point of view, that's a real concern for us.
And he wants local governments to make buses available for travelling teams, particularly in regional areas.
They're often driving longer distances. They've got to travel further to be able to compete or participate in sporting opportunities.
Rochelle Imey is a professor of sports science at Federation University. She researches community sport participation and believes the full impact of the fuel pinch is yet to come.
So we've had school holidays and then we've only really had 2 weeks of sort of winter sports. I think we'll see it in the coming weeks and months, but it's not just going to be the families of the you know, the players, you know, the young children and youth and their parents. But it's going to have a ripple effect. It's the volunteers in the clubs and the spectators.
It's not just the immediate impacts that she's worried about. She says there'll be future impacts too.
If you haven't played footy for a couple of years and you're up against children that have, or any sport for that matter, it's really hard. So once often children, you know, drop out, unfortunately, it's very difficult sometimes to come back.
In a statement, WA Minister for Sport and Recreation, Rita Saffiotti, says support with cost of living pressures remains a key priority, and she'll have more to say in next month's budget.
Samantha Girling and Isabel Massali with that report. To Australian art buyers, he was marketed as an internationally acclaimed sculptor, a French recluse working out of Paris. But a background briefing investigation has discovered that the mysterious artist, known as Jean-Paul Marjon, is not French, not based in France, and was never shipping work from Paris at all. The commercial Melbourne Australian Art Gallery representing the artist maintains that revealing who they really are would cause serious psychological harm. Julia Bergen reports.
For years, an Australian art gallery told buyers the same intriguing story.
A much-awaited shipment from Paris. Seductive sculptural works from Jean-Paul Marjon have now arrived. Worth the wait.
The works are brightly coloured plastic sculptures that look like giant, crumpled post-it notes, and they're exclusive to Studio Gallery Group. Eliza Merley ran the gallery's operations and logistics until 2024 and hasn't forgotten the spiel about their creator.
I give sort of the spiel that I'd just pulled from online, which was that he was a Parisian artist who was making works in Paris. He was internationally critically acclaimed.
But when clients pushed for specifics, where had he exhibited? Who had collected his work? She says those answers were hard to come by. Staff were told Jean-Paul Marjon was unreachable and all contact must go through the gallery owner, Kerry Armstrong. Then there was the question of how his work arrived.
They'd come in our studio gallery van, often just sort of wrapped in one layer of bubble wrap.
The ABC has spoken to 11 former Studio Gallery Group employees who worked across the gallery's five locations over a period of 4 years. Several of them explained that Jean-Paul Marjon's sculptures turned up with none of the hallmarks of international freight. When the ABC put questions to Studio Gallery Group, a different picture emerged. The gallery's representatives confirmed that Jean-Paul Marjon is a nom de plume and that the artist behind it is not French, not based in France, and was not shipping works from Paris either. Eliza Merley says she was left with one question.
I wonder why they felt the need to keep that from their staff.
But the questions don't end there. Sydney artist Anya Perche also makes brightly coloured plastic sculptures that, just like Jean-Paul Marjon's, look like giant, crumpled post-it notes. And like Jean-Paul Marjon, Anya Perche was also represented by Studio Gallery Group. When she left in 2021, his works started to appear.
And it was very confusing. Images were appearing on social media, attributed to him. People were going, hey, look, you know, this works that look similar, but it's not yours. What's going on?
Ever since, Anya Perche has been on a quest to find out who is Jean-Paul Marjon. Consumer law expert Rebecca Gay, who would not comment specifically on Jean-Paul Marjon, says Australian consumer law requires businesses to be truthful about the characteristics and origin of the goods they sell.
If that story is misrepresenting that the artwork itself comes from a different country, that could be problematic.
The gallery's owners, Kerry and Michael Armstrong, declined an interview. In statements, they said the gallery categorically rejects the premise, tone, and methods of Background Briefing's investigation, and they're disappointed by the misinformation peddled by a few disenfranchised individuals. They also said the circumstances around the creation and adoption of the artist's pseudonym are strictly confidential, and that an audit of the gallery's current marketing material found no concerns. Jean-Paul Marjon, who the ABC attempted to contact via the gallery, did not respond to questions.
Julia Bergen. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As a nation of travellers, the Iran war has created huge uncertainty. over whether we can still go ahead with our holiday plans and how much more it's going to cost us to fly. Today, aviation expert Ian Douglas on where things currently stand and what to expect if the war doesn't end soon. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.